the Howard Street Tunnel fire. 11 cars derailed, 4 of which contained hazardous materials. Now, this happened to have happened during a rush hour when there was about to be a baseball season, a baseball game. So there are photos of thousands of people having to take to the streets because transit systems were disrupted, power was out, a water main broke, the Coast Guard temporarily shut the inner harbor. So there was tremendous disruption in an urban setting. Thankfully, no loss of life. The fire did go on for 5 days, with train service resuming on July 24th. In this case here, we were talking about a critical link in a multi-state network involving a single mode. Importantly, most of the commodities involved were not time sensitive. This enabled CSX to either reroute trains or delay others in yards and notify customers of delays ranging from 18 to 35 hours. Where there was a high priority time sensitive shipment, such as the Tropicana Orange Blossom Special, which contained temperature controlled product from Tropicana moving from Florida to New Jersey. This is where organizations work together. CSX was able to work with Norfolk Southern to reroute that train over the NS system and deliver those loads on time. In terms of the impacts, they were on the community more than they were on the supply chain. So as a result, in terms of looking at the long term, there really was not an impact on rail freight movement. However, the fact that hazardous materials cars were involved in a fire in the middle of a major metropolitan area did bring more scrutiny to the movement of hazardous materials, both by the supply chain transportation providers and by the shippers and receivers. And we've seen some of the shifts that have happened as a result of that in the 10 years since. For example, there's a petrochemical company in New Jersey that received a highly hazardous material from a supplier in Louisiana. That plant is now closing and is co-locating next to the supplier, replacing a long-distance rail movement of a very hazardous material with a short piece of pipeline movement from the supplier. Such co-locations are happening more and more when it comes to hazardous material movement. So switching now to talk about Superstorm Sandy and some background for people joining us from outside the New York, New Jersey area. Just to set the stage, to show where the Port of New York and New Jersey is located, it is a bi-state port with facilities on both sides of the Hudson River. On the left, we have the Port Newark Elizabeth Complex. On Staten Island, the Holland Hook Marine Terminal. Closer into the Hudson River area is Port Jersey, which includes the Global Marine Terminal, and the Greenville Yard, which includes a car float operation connecting to Brooklyn. The Brooklyn Marine Terminal includes the Red Hook Container Terminal. The Port of New York, New Jersey is the third largest container port in the U.S. and the largest on the East Coast. In 2011, it handled more than 5.5 million TEUs. Also a major importer and exporter of automobiles, and handled over 650,000 vehicles in 2011. Those of us who are in the region started hearing about the potential for a severe storm, maybe akin to Irene, the Thursday before the Monday of the event. Transportation agencies and other emergency prepared organizations started working out plans and activating operation centers. However, it wasn't until Sunday, the day before the storm, that it became clear that the New York, New Jersey area would be the epicenter of this very powerful weather event. So at that time, Mayor Bloomberg, Governor Christie began mandatory evacuations of areas. Transit systems, New Jersey Transit, PATH, New York City Metropolitan Transportation Systems, Amtrak, began orderly shutdowns of their system commensurate with the evacuations of areas. The freight railroads began to reposition their trains and locomotives, moving them from potentially dangerous areas and repositioning them knowing that there was going to be some diversion of vessels. By Sunday evening, the ports of New York and New Jersey had asked all the terminals to close and keep just the emergency personnel. Monday morning, everyone was evacuated, except for a few security people, and their locations were well known. The two pictures on the right were taken by a security guard in the midst of the storm at the Holland Hook Marine Terminal in Staten Island. And this gives some idea of the severity of the event, because we were talking by 8 o'clock that evening of winds of 90 miles an hour and surges of 14 feet, way above Irene. This was not a gentle rising of water. Those are white caps breaking in the middle of the Holland Hook Marine Terminal. Tuesday, it was nice and sunny, but there was no power and lots of devastation. Immediately, the assessment, the recovery, the response began. In addition, this is where other ports and other modes swung into action. The port had been closed. There were vessels that were diverted to Baltimore and Virginia. CSX and other railroads had qualified crews and set up temporary routes to move containers from those ports back up to New York. Truckers also were sent by customers to go pick up their containers. There were credentialing issues, and there were issues in terms of allowing containers to be picked up at those locations. So again, this is the consideration on a regulatory level. By Friday, or already at Friday after the storm, the Coast Guard had inspected the channels and reopened the port for deep draft movement. The first vessel arriving at the Port Authority facility was actually a cruise ship, the Brilliance of the Seas, which was called on Bayonne, New Jersey, offloading 3,500 passengers and taking 3,500 passengers on. Unfortunately, the Bayonne cruise terminal was one of the areas most deeply affected, and those 3,500 passengers getting off probably found they didn't have cars anymore. November 3rd, power was restored in the Port Elizabeth section, which contains two major container terminals, MOP and APM Maersk. By Sunday, five vessels were working at those terminals. Labor, management, everyone worked together to bring the port back online. By Monday,
the power went out.
By
Tuesday, biggest challenge for them was power and fuel. Nobody had gasoline, even when the powers came back on, no one had gasoline. They had to drive out to Pennsylvania to actually get it. I think it was about 2 or 3 days they lost power.
The damage was extensive.
It wasn't as bad as
flooding of
salt water. In buildings maybe up to 5 feet high and across the facility. The container cranes stood their ground, having hurricane lashing. However, the electric motors at their bases were submerged in salt water and had to be cleaned and redone for use. There was numerous damage to security fencing, which is important for customs clearance, as well as damage to roadways and rail switches. Container stacks were knocked over. There was debris in the road, containers in the channels, on the rail tracks, on the turnpike, and there was a total loss of the rail car float at Greenville Yard. The cargo impacts included the stacked containers that were damaged. Thousands of cars were destroyed by the flooding and damage down there. And of course, the cruise passengers had lost their vehicles. These are pictures of Greenville Yard before the storm, a legacy facility and the last rail car float in New Jersey, connecting New Jersey directly to Brooklyn via rail car float on barges. That is a picture taken from the barge looking at the float. And this is what Greenville Yard looked like after Sandy. The structures are completely gone, and one of the barges had broken in two and sank. In terms of the terminals, again, the containers knocked over. Security fencing, gatehouses knocked over, sitting on rail, And it gives an idea of the breakup of the road and the amount of mud and debris that had to be cleared to become operational again. The Red Hook barge, which moves containers between Brooklyn and Port of Newark Elizabeth, was not just at berth 6, it was on berth 6. Flotation devices had to be brought under it, raise it level, and float it out again. One of the items in terms of starting up and moving forward was availability of chassis. And unfortunately, thousands of chassis were badly damaged by salt water, which affects the electronics and the brake drums. Each chassis taking anywhere from 3 to 15 hours to be brought back to road readiness. In addition, trucks that performed drayage activities were damaged, at least several hundred of them. And this gives an example of the kind of damage to the road. The building damage also exemplifies how significant the water flow was just bursting through the wall. And again, some idea of the cargo impact with the picture on the bottom right being voted best imitation of a Tetris form by containers. The port is operational and the recovery continues, particularly off-peak and in the evening. In terms of the car float, the Port Authority, working with New York City Economic Development Corporation, was able to bring over a float bridge from Brooklyn to restart service. Perhaps the best way of describing the storm is that it's an example of when things are at their worst, people are at that best, at their best. And with that, I thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Anne. We will now move into our second presentation by Don Snyder of the Port of Long Beach. And Don, if you are, or when you are ready, you may begin.
Okay, I'm ready to go. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, very good. Well, I enjoyed Anne's presentation, and I feel a little tough following up from her because she had very dramatic pictures and really painted a very clear picture of a natural disaster. What I'm going to do is our situation here will focus on the impact of a labor dispute. And so just a quick background for the Port of Long Beach. We're in a bay that's contiguous with the Port of Los Angeles, and in terms of volume, Port of LA is number one in North America, and we're number two. And if you combine our container volume, we're number six in the world at about 14 million TEUs, or 20-foot equivalent units. So it's probably about somewhere between 11 and 12 million containers per year. As far as operations, both of us port authorities here in Southern California are landlord ports. So we develop the infrastructure, but we don't operate that. We feel that private operators have a better handle on operating that. And so between the two ports, we have exactly 13 container terminals and more or less 30 other terminals of other container types. And so what we're going to focus on is in 2012, this past year, it was a strike by the longshoremen group called the OCU, or Office Clerical Unit. And what I'd like to first do is kind of compare and contrast that with some other labor situations and the effect. First of all, we hadn't had an actual strike since, I believe it's 1971 on the waterfront. But in 2002, during the labor contract negotiations, they eventually came to a point where there was no agreement. And at that point, the management locked out labor. And that affected the entire U.S. West Coast. All the ports are under the same contract. So that happened for the entire U.S. West Coast, and also happened during the peak season for imports. Primarily, the West Coast ports, as far as on the containerized operation, are in a good spot between the manufacturing of consumer goods in Asia and the consumption of those goods in North America. So that occurred, the strike occurred, or the lockout occurred in October, so there's a lot of the holiday season goods, the most urgent and last of them, are coming in during that period. And that lockout was for 10 days, and then there was a lot of digging out from there. In 2004, what was an actual contract dispute, but due to some shortages of rail labor, there was a backup of cargo into the ports, and a lack of proper labor levels caused congestion. And that was focused in Southern California and affected all the terminals. And then finally, the issue that we'll talk about today, the OCU strike, was in Southern California, but it did not affect all the terminals. It was focused around just the container business, and actually not all the container terminals were affected. So the OCU strike started on November 27th, and it started at one terminal, one of the 13 terminals, and spread to the remaining terminals the next day, and the closure was for 8 days. Again, it was the first strike that we've seen since the 70s. And so the labor was focused on, this unit is actually office workers, but they're also a division of the longshore labor that does all the vessel operations. So these clerks, as they put up pickets, ended up closing 10 of 14 container terminals in the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles, as recommended by the group here, have included a map. And if you look on the left side, that's the port of Los Angeles. Again, we share a bay, and we have a political boundary down the middle, and we share infrastructure needs, security and environmental things, but we compete like business, like crazy. In the Port of Los Angeles, they had one terminal open, which is the light blue one called TraPac. In the Port of Long Beach, we had three terminals that remained open. Pier A, in, I guess my wife would call that Taup. Then we had Pier C in the light green, and another version of light green, Pier J, remained open. Those companies were able to resolve their issues with that union and remain open. Okay, so during these 8 days, what were the impacts? What happened? First of all, and I'd like to separate this out into a couple things, is cargo moves, both in a flow of information as well as cargo. First thing that we learned in 2002 was that although we're landlord ports and we don't do the operations, we have a responsibility and to help provide information on what's going on. And it's not just for the local community, but the people that are in the supply chain, the cargo owners, rail, and the ship owners are throughout different parts of the country and different parts of the world. And although they have local offices and agents, is that the more information they have, the better decisions they can make on how they continue to flow their business. So in 2002, the void was filled by a Marine Exchange of Southern California. Basically, they're like the air traffic controllers for ships everywhere from the Mexican border up to Port Hueneme. And they put out a daily email that indicated You know, who's closed, who's open, what's the situation with getting labor, and various types of information that helped the different parties of the supply chain to make decisions. In the 2012 situation, we were able as a port authority to provide information on who's open, who's closed, what's going on, and that was very important, again, to the supply chain to have visibility as to what's going on there. Because there wasn't a complete shutdown of the port, it helped keep effects to a minimum. So, again, we had the four container terminals that remained open. So the trucking companies, working with their customer, the cargo owner, would identify, and using the pretty sophisticated cargo tracking systems, what cargo was available, and continue to work those four terminals as much as possible, one, to keep the product flowing through the supply chain, and to keep product out of the terminals so that those terminals would not go into gridlock. And it flowed very well. One of the things that occurred in Southern California after 2002, but very much helped in our situation now, is a program we call Peer Pass. It's actually the private terminal operators have put together a program, and what it does is that most ports have their gates open for trucks to deliver exports and pick up imports 5 days a week from 8 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon, regular business hours. Because of congestion on the highways, we worked with a number of entities, and like I said, our terminal operators put together a Peer Pass program, which opened up an additional 5 gate shifts at either on weekdays at night or on Saturday, providing additional time for cargo to be picked up and delivered. And that extra capacity has been very key to not only relieving traffic congestion in the long run, but in situations where there's interruptions, people are able to flex the capacity to different hours, quite a bit different hours. And another key thing with it is that prior to Peer Pass, when you tried to open up gate and truck operations at marine terminals on a as-needed basis, there was a huge learning curve, and usually a lot of mistakes happen and very low productivity. But because Peer Pass has been institutionalized since 2005, it's a normal process, so that extra capacity can be used effectively. So between the truckers and the cargo owners, they spent a lot of time focusing on what cargo could be picked up. Rail is about somewhere about 65-75% of our cargo volume actually is on the import side is destined east of the Rockies, and it's going on rail either directly in containers, or it's being transloaded into domestic intermodal boxes and then moved onward. With the interruption of the supply chain, the railroads are very closely lined up with the ocean carriers and terminal operators on information of how the cargo is going to be coming in the upcoming week. So the railroads on the export side of things began staging export containers on sidings out in the desert in numerous locations, so that once the strike was over, that they were prepared to move those exports out, as well as staging empty rail cars for the imports to make sure that, again, as the terminals opened up, they were prepared to move cargo quickly. Then ocean carriers had to make decisions as far as how long do they wait with cargo to get into Southern California. The cost of diversion, of moving a ship to another port, is not only the cost of the ship and the fuel, and so forth. But in addition to that, there is a heavy intermodal cost of that, and you have to balance that against the ships are heavy in fixed costs. Every day a ship is sitting around, some of the newer, larger ships that we're seeing could be a $100,000 a day impact. So the carriers had to decide how long to wait. The other thing, as far as on the public sector, is that we practice a lot of business continuity. Most of that, our drills and practices, are for natural disasters, such as Ann pointed out with Sandy, Hurricane Sandy. But they do provide us with the ability to work within our organization and quickly assess what is our role, who do we need to work with. In this case, our role was during the strike to anticipate if there was any severe disagreements that we had security available. Fortunately, things were peaceful. There were disputes on business issues, but nothing that required security. But also, as we had volumes concentrated at four terminals, there were traffic management issues that we needed to coordinate closely with the supply chain community. And then again, as the strike ended, heavy volumes were there, and a lot of truck traffic that needed to be managed, and that was our part. So again, on the Port of Long Beach side of the bay, we had three out of our six terminals still operating. And an interesting thing is a lot of the ocean carriers on the containerized side of the business do vessel sharing arrangements. Competitors will share each other's vessels so that they have a lot more services and assets without spending extra money. And they also do a lot of terminal sharing. So on the Port of Long Beach, a number of vessels that would have been stranded in the strike were able to move to another terminal that was open within Long Beach, and we ended up with no vessels diverted. And the supply chain here, it's interesting with being a pretty tight-knit community, as well as the flow of information that private industry has. Within a little over a week, most of the terminals were caught up into their normal operations, and they had the capacity to meet these surges in that we have sufficient numbers of longshoremen, capital equipment, and long operating hours to handle this business. Just the impact on operations, and I know Paul is our economist, so I'll try and stay away from much of the numbers, but we estimate between the two ports that there's about $1 billion a day of cargo flowing through. So for the 8 days, we had $8 billion worth of cargo delayed. You have to take that down by a certain percentage because of some terminals open. But we also had the tens of thousands of jobs that were impacted. The longshoremen, as opposed to us office workers, they get hired on a day-to-day basis. So if there is no work, then they're not getting paid. So there was, on the nine container terminals that were closed, there was quite a number of wages not being received for those 8 days. Same as the truckers operate in the harbor area. They're owner-operators, so they're only going to be working as there is work available. So fortunately, there was some terminals to keep them going. Cargo owners and brokers that are responsible for moving the cargo, and a lot of it's retail, is that being that there was a week delay and this is after the Christmas rush, everything should be in the stores by the time this delay happened, were able to just continue to look at their inventories, what was in each container, and prioritize that as the operations opened up. Lost business opportunities. There were actually 17 vessels diverted from the Port of Los Angeles, and most of that was partial. diversions, that they would go up to Oakland or another port and dump off either all the Oakland cargo and then come back and not divert to his, you know, the total amount of cargo available. So they saw more of the vessels depart. We were fortunate on the Long Beach side, again, with three terminals open, that there was a number of vessels that were able to find homes. And as far as things go, it's a fairly recent time since the vessels got started up and terminal operations are going. And we saw the busiest December that we've ever seen in the Port of Long Beach for imports. And as far as anything related to the strike or the aftermath, was that there were no interruptions or delays to cargo flow. So with that, I will turn it back over for the next presentation.
Thank you very much, Don. Our next presenter will be Paul Bingham from CDM Smith. And Paul, when you are ready, you can begin.
Thank you, Nick, and thank you to Ann and Don for very enlightening presentations. They make very interesting case studies for what I'm going to try to talk about conceptually a little bit more in the abstract. And I apologize, this is going to be a little less exciting in terms of the visuals, because I'm going to be talking in more generic terms about how you assess the impacts of temporary U.S. port closures on international supply chains and the U.S. economy. Looking from a very broad scale, defining a disruption as anything that's interrupting the flow of cargo through a port or a terminal or a series of ports. First of all, for some perspective, for those of you that haven't studied closely the role of the container business, and I'm focusing here mostly on container ports, though there's a lot of this that's just generalizable to seaports that handle any sort of cargo. Fundamentally, ports have increased their importance in the U.S. economy in the last few decades as economic growth has been predicated on continued growth in trade. That's not only something that's a result of increasing globalization, but actually explicit government policy with the President's National Export Initiative, amongst other efforts to try to increase the benefits to U.S. consumers and businesses from more trade, through which the ports are the places that most of that cargo moves. The relative importance of components of U.S. trade vary, and that goes down to the level of which ports are seeing what relative growth, or for that matter, seaports versus other modes of transport. Example I gave here was just the long-term decline in importance of North Atlantic sea trade as our traditional trading partners in North Europe became less important than, say, our trading partners in Asia over the last few decades, which then had direct impacts on the ports that serve those trade lines. Compositionally, within trade itself, the cargo matters. Trade in lighter weight and higher value products, those that tend to be those found most suitable to be containerized, continues to outpace the trade growth in the bulk commodities that are more slower growing, though still move in enormous volumes, which has had the result of increasing the relative importance of container ports in the economy in terms of proportion of trade. Most importantly, from an economist's perspective, the value of trade for the country. That's not only just between the goods that move maritime versus in dry bulk or in liquid bulk versus container, but also air cargo versus sea cargo, where improvements in liner vessel services and container trades have actually eroded some of the air cargo share in recent years. There have been efforts across the industry over the very long term to take advantages of economies of scale of this growing trade volume. And this is most importantly for port disruption impacts from the perspective of larger equipment, larger container ships, larger cranes, longer trains, all of which has the effect of reducing unit costs of moving those goods in normal times, but it also reduces the number of potential alternative ports or facilities or equipment quickly available in the case of interruption. In other words, able to concentrate cargo into larger individual units of movement activity also makes it more difficult to replicate that when there's a disruption. So consequently, any interruption in the supply chains that uses gateway container port system is, at least I believe, over the long term, every year more important to the U.S. economy that has a share of the vulnerability. Another way to look at the potential for impacts of disruptions are by looking at transportation services and associated logistics costs that are incurred in the economy. Now, this graph here is not specific to international trade, let alone sea trade or container trade. It's from the Council of Supply Chain Management Professionals. It's their estimate for 2011 of total logistics costs. But the point is here that the transportation cost proportion of this is still the large majority of transportation with this cost. This is the landed cost that an importer or what an exporter faces in serving an end market in terms of their cost of transport from that origination point to the destination point of final origination to final destination. So transportation costs, of which the port handling and the vessel services and the rail costs and the truck drayage are all a component, are very important from an economic perspective in terms of what these costs actually are in the system. So now let's turn to the factors that affect the supply chain and ultimately the economy from interruptions. And there's a couple of dimensions that I think are fundamental to being able to estimate the size of economic impacts or even understanding the nature of disruptions. The first of which, I believe, is anticipation. It's interruptions that can be anticipated even by a few hours or better days or even longer, for example, a lockout or a strike, or in some cases even a storm, can have costs reduced by advanced action. That's the mitigation you take ahead of time to most simply get equipment off the wharves or get the vessels out to sea, or something more strategic where you actually advance shipping or divert to other ports to minimize potential disruptions to the supply chain by taking whatever action you can with as much time as got to minimize that. So anticipation here is critical. Now, you could say a natural disaster, there's very little that can be done, but through advanced planning, actually, there's interactions here, and I'll talk about that shortly. But also in terms of anticipation, there's also following things that are institutional that are not physical. So for example, contract expiration dates matter. So we saw planning last year in advance of the expiration of the ILA, union contract on the Eastern Gulf Coast, in advance of a potential strike there. The next factor is duration, and perhaps this is becomes most critical to understand in terms of the real impacts on the economy broadly. Interruption impacts are a nonlinear function of time. That means that it's not continuous in terms of escalation of costs the longer you see a disruption. Initial costs, in fact, are often built into the system. A few-hour disruption has costs that are very low at the margin, because very often there's enough slack in the system such that those get smoothed out and get taken up to available capacity and normal everyday operations of flexibility. But as the duration of interruptions expand quickly, they escalate quite rapidly, and there is a period, depending upon the circumstance or the location or some of these other factors, the impacts from days to weeks to several months become much, much greater. But after a period of time, and it depends on all those same circumstances, the overall system will adjust, and further impacts actually increase at a greatly diminished rate, so that if you get to a very long disruption, you have a new equilibrium, essentially, at which those additional impacts are diminished. Don mentioned already seasonality matters. Interruptions to flows of trade matter because they're not constant. The amount of cargo handled in any one week varies quite greatly. In fact, the typical swing pattern on import container flows in the U.S. is about a 20% peak to trough seasonally every year, from the peak season in late summer into the fall, and then the slow season right about now, starting in December into February. So it matters a lot when it happens how much cargo is even subject to the disruption. And finally, critically, is the economic geographic scope. How much of the system is actually going to be affected by the disruption? Is it port-wide, as we saw in the metro area with Sandy? Is it, like Don was just talking about, a subset of the terminals within two ports? Or is it coast-wide, like we saw with the 2002 lockout of the container ports, or what has been threatened with the potential ILA strike for the East and the Gulf Coasts coming still potentially this year? These factors are all interrelated, and that's what makes it complex sometimes to try to figure out what the impacts are. There's another dimension to looking at impacts to try to understand the repercussions for an economy, and that's the split, what you can call the direct and the indirect impacts, the direct being that immediate lost economic activity at the port. reports and related functions in the system due to the disruption. And you can measure that in terms of lost employment, associated lost wages and income. There's the depreciated value of damaged, destroyed assets if it's something like a natural disaster, and you can account for that. And then there's the indirect impacts, which can be much more extensive as those the disruption right at the port facilities extends on into the economy through the lost revenue and employment of associated industries and providers that cuts across the modes of transport. There's the lost output of an employment from lower exports if you've impeded trade long enough so that you've actually lost some export sales. Similarly, there's lost output and employment due to the disruption of imports of intermediate goods that feed into domestic manufacturing, or perhaps you see a shutdown such as we saw of some facilities back with the lockout in 2002. There's also the indirect effects on output and employment in all industries caused by those first-round effects. As income is reduced and employment goes down, that has a ripple effect all through the economy. So in total, the economy-wide effects on prices, consumer spending can be measured and ultimately can be seen even at the level of the nation's whole gross domestic product if it's a big enough disruption. And we'll talk a little bit later about some estimates of what that might be. If we look at the consequences of extended interruptions, what might actually happen if we get a disruption to supply chains through seaports over a more extended period of time, which I won't attempt to define explicitly here, but understand that if we have a disruption that is enough that it really affects the supply chain functioning, you see diversions or lower productivity will be a certain consequence, as will be a reduction in the velocity of supply chains from this disruption, whatever it is. And that has the impact of raising the total delivered cost, raising that price of trade, if you will, if it makes the imports more expensive or reduces your exports by making them less competitive. From the import side, cost increases pressure retailers or importers to realign sourcing. Ultimately, they're trying to minimize costs, and that can include shifting the countries of origin. They could say, well, I can't rely on the supply chain, so I'm going to ship to another supplier, another location. There may even be product substitution where you can't get a particular product, so you buy something else as a substitute, perhaps from another source that includes domestically. There are revisions that happen as a consequence of any disruption, whether it's from a natural disaster, as we've seen repeatedly over the last few decades, or other disruptions such as strikes. Some of those take quite a long time to play out. The revisions to supply chains can be very rapid, but they can also take an enormous amount of time in terms of actually years as investments and decision-making opportunities come along where the risk minimization and the ability to change some of the situations related to sunk costs come up for businesses, so that over time, you can see changes happening that are a consequence of disruptions that were even many years before. And we saw that after the port disruptions on the West Coast with the lockout in 2002 and the congestion in 2004 to 2005. It took many years to see the full impact of those changes. Similarly, we've seen some similar lags related to the disruptions that happened with Katrina on the Gulf Coast several years ago. Ultimately, in the economy, the increased costs will be mostly passed through to the customers, and that reduces their ability to spend on imports or it reduces export sales by making those exports less competitive, as I've mentioned. Ultimately, it reduces the economic performance of the economy, and the effect of that is through the changes in trade. That's actually how you can see the impact of it. So as an exercise to try to estimate the permanent economic impacts of an interruption, so you do the full accounting, however many years it takes later to look at what has happened, there's a couple of things that we've got to do, and that includes considering the extent to which the impacted activity represents a permanent loss to the economy. And the contrast for that, as Don mentioned, there's this knee-jerk reaction to say, well, how much trade is affected when we have a disruption? And the first numbers that are easiest to get is say, well, what's the average value of trade moving through those ports each day? And you say, okay, well, there's the impact. Well, in fact, that's not the impact, because you'd have to sink the ships. You'd have to lose all the cargo if those impacts actually amounted to that much, because most of that cargo eventually gets delivered. Now, perhaps there's some perishables that have degraded in value, or perhaps lost all their economic value, but for the most part, those goods eventually get delivered to their final destinations, unless the duration is much longer. So you really need to look at a net impact over a longer period of time when you see the remediation and the recovery steps and take into account what happens. When that includes all the steps that were taken to mitigate potential impacts of advancing or delaying shipment dates, or finding alternative routing, or accelerating production in advance, or cargo handling afterwards. All of these can be minimized in terms of their impacts through advanced planning. As Don mentioned, there are planning steps and even drills across facilities and organizations that try to deal with disruptions so that when they do occur, their impacts will be minimized and the institutions, the organizations will function as best as they can under those conditions, all of which helps reduce the losses and reduce the effect on the economy. A framework for doing that is to look here. I've got a chart which is a little confusing to follow. It starts actually in the second box, the supply chain interruption or whatever type it is. That's the direct impact. And then, as I've mentioned before, the indirect impacts can be then measured through the trading and support industries related to that, quantified in terms of reductions in income, whether that's individuals and households or businesses. And then looking at the consequence in terms of their expenditures and back through to final demands to see, well, what did it actually do in the economy to reduce the output? There was an example exercise done looking at various duration disruptions. Timing-wise, just picked at random somewhat as the first quarter in a year for U.S. West Coast container ports. So this is a disruption of all West Coast container ports, sort of echoing the lockout of 2002 in terms of scale or scope. And then of different durations here, and this is somewhat random, but of a five-day, think of it as sort of a one business week and then two business weeks and then 20 days to double that, measured in three different concepts, the full-time equivalent jobs lost, so this is a job equivalent on a job year basis, and then personal income, and then finally U.S. real GDP, the top line number for the whole economy. And the estimates here show this nonlinear nature of disruption impacts, where that five-day disruption to the entire coast, biggest source and region of import handling in the country, resulted in the loss of 155,000 jobs. But look at double that to 10 days, and it's 162,000. So not a lot in that first window period of ramp up. There's some minimum amounts of disruption that are immediate, but that doesn't extrapolate enormously through that 5 to 10 day period. And remember, Don was talking here about an 8 day disruption with this OCU strike for those limited number terminals. Even back in 2002, we had a 10 day disruption. So it's really this middle range here. Income losses of 0.6 billion on the 5 day and doubling in the 10 day. But then notice that 20 day, the increases are substantial as you get up into this much more significant disruption period in terms of supply chain functioning and the repercussions through the economy. And that's consistent through all three of these metrics, where the net to the whole country's economy is less than a billion from a five-day disruption on net in the long term. The 10-day is a little bit more than double that, and then if we look at the 20-day, it becomes much, much more substantial. And this is where these longer duration disruptions become much more significant in terms of the permanent cost to the economy and what it means for the country. And these are the kinds of disruptions that the planners and those that are trying to deal with mitigation to try to minimize the impacts really need to focus. It's not so much necessarily the one-day disruptions. It's those medium to longer-term ones that become much more significant if they were to occur, and therefore warrant much more attention in terms of planning resources associated with them. So let me wrap up with the last slide and make the point that infrastructure alone, including public infrastructure and logistics practices, can amplify or reduce these impacts to the supply chain. So Don's just talked about the ability for the ports of LA and Long Beach to deploy reserve capacity. They've got some limits, but in both operational and physical, but they've actually been able to fine-tune the availability of that so that fortuitously when it happens not in peak season and they're not pushing their capacity, they have the ability to recover relatively quickly from what was a very significant volume disruption to cargo movement through planning and through the systems that are in place. Similarly, and you mentioned the railroads and for that matter the truckers, able to also take some steps to try to mitigate the impacts on them. The dimensions around the inland system include the geographic concentration of use of the system to handle the port cargo. That includes moving cargo through alternate corridors if it's possible, or as we saw in LA Long Beach, alternative terminals. In other circumstances, that could be terminals at other ports, such as we saw with Sandy, where there were some vessel diversions to other East Coast ports. if there is this slack capacity, this is the safety stock concept, not just for a retailer with a warehouse, but if you think of it as safety stock in the transportation network, is there capacity there to have throughput service capacity that is not used on an everyday basis, but in case of disruption is available to be deployed, even if it's at a higher cost, say you're paying overtime to a qualified worker. We look across the modes that support cargo on the land side. Trucking networks are more dynamic than fixed rail networks, but both face capacity limitations, especially in the short run. On the trucking side, it's more the drivers and the equipment, especially with the operating rules that we have for them and the competitiveness of the business that doesn't allow for slack capacity. And on the rail side, similarly, there's actually labor and power and equipment limitations that extend beyond what's there in the track network. There's a degree of uniqueness to port trucking and rail operations that's correlated with the cost of substitutes. You can't just bring an average drive-in trailer in onto the wharf and necessarily start transloading all these containers. This is an issue in terms of the efficiency of the system under normal conditions, makes it more difficult perhaps to mitigate through the general capacity and the broader freight transport system in the event of a disruption, and understanding that in terms of what that requires for planning. And finally, the use of lean logistics practices continues in industry. Inventory still gets managed tightly by retailers and manufacturers, and that still creates some vulnerabilities. We've seen that as repercussions from disruptions to operations such as in Japan in 2011 that carried back through to the U.S. And the use of trucks and terminal storage, including at ports as warehousing, actually expands the service vulnerability of the system a little bit more to disruption if those facilities or that equipment is then disrupted due to either some weather disaster or something else. So I guess the point for this audience really is that advanced planning is what's critical, and to minimize the impacts, it really takes the community collectively to be able to do it. And as Don just testified to, that we've seen through this OCU strike, our combination of players had to be able to react to make sure that the impacts were as minimal as possible, and that covered multiple modes and both the public and private sector's involvement in making sure that happened, and it was built on the experience of dealing with disruptions in the past. So that completes my prepared remarks, and I look forward to participating in the Q&A. Thank you.